they call it, they give it a different name, though, Deadhead Cypress. I mean, see, I've heard talk some of that.
Barbara's our cypress specialist. You want to tell us about all the varieties of cypress and what it's like to work with it?
Well, I wouldn't call an expert on cypress, but mostly we deal with is tidewater red. You know, that's just plain old cypress that's been grown in the deep swamps. All the loggers go out there and they go in the swamps. I wouldn't like to have their job, but he goes out there in that swamp and cut it down and bring it to us, and we got easy work because we don't have to get wet and in the mud and all that. They're like them loggers, but now they do have. I heard of black cypress. I have heard of yellow cypress. Now a lot of white cypress. If anybody walked on the Swanee River branch out there, you see all that cypress growing there. That's plain white cypress.
You were talking about pecky and plain. Explain about that.
Okay. Pecky cypress is where a tree been in the swamps for a long period of time, and what it does is just stay there so long, and it got a fungus. The fungus will go start growing up that tree, start from the bottom and come on up to the top. Okay, sometimes they cut that tree before that fungus had hit it all the way up to the top. They might get a bowl out, a 12-inch bowl. It might have 5 inches of that is pecking. So what we do, we take that bowl and we lay it aside. We put that on a special order because pecky wood is real delicate and it real expensive. So you want to handle that with screen caution, because as you drop it, what it's going to do is just fall apart. What we do, we take it and dry it out, and then we plane it down real good, and then sell it.
One thing that I realized in talking to folks who'd worked in the mills is that, as Mr. Solomon alluded to before, it's not often not a real safe job, although much more so now. But he has quite a story. Will you tell him about the saw blade incident?
Yes. Some of the cypress, too. He can tell you something about
I tell you this, sawing oak. Yeah. Well, of course, back in 1959, never will forget the year. It was cold, the highway cracked. And this oak we were sawing, that's what we mostly saw was oak. Sometimes pine, cypress, but most of it was oatmeal. That's what it really was called. This bandsaw, you have to put water on it. It's a saw, it's about 8 foot long. I'm not for sure, but it's from 7 or 8 foot long. And there's a wheel up there and one down here, and you slip the saw on the top wheel and the bottom wheel. Then it's the fellow who trips the slabs. He stands on the side, you tighten it up. The top wheel goes up, and that makes it tighten up on it. But in the meantime, you still have to run water on the saw at all times. Keep the saw from getting hot and it'll come on. But this particular morning when it was so cold, the logs were frozen. Then we didn't think it was that cold, but the man, the saw, he went up to the log, and the saw is probably about 10 to 12 inches wide when it's new, because they weighed it down to about 6 inches before they throw it away. The saw turned just as he went up to the log. He went in to try to saw at the board and it turned. Sink. He had to back up.
It was cold.
So he went back up to it again. It did the same thing. So he went up to the third time and he went up in about 4 or 5 inches and the saw came off the wheel. The bandsaw came off the wheel, come up on the carriage. I was standing up and the saw went over my head, cut across the shoulders, across the little part of my back, and across the thigh leg down here. And then cut my clothes, it cut my clothes. 3 different places across then. And yes, I'm lefty. Yes, the Lord's with me. I reckon about 10 or 15 minutes after then, I had to knock off. But fact about it, we couldn't go to work. No, we couldn't work. No way. But he had to carry me home. Yeah, I was so scared. I didn't get scared till just about 10 or 15 minutes afterwards. I got so scared. Of course, it happened so quick. It didn't have time to do anything, but I just see how close I was to death, though. It was really wrong.
Anybody out there have a question that they'd like to ask of any of these folks? About their work? Yeah.
What kind of wood species was in the pine wood? You can make plywood out of just about any species. Our mill is just strictly a pine mill. That's the only kind of plywood we make. But we were talking earlier here about hardwood plywood. There's, like I say, you can make hardwood or plywood out of any kind of wood, depending on what the end use of it's going to be. But a lot of what you see, a lot of furniture that's made now isn't made with solid wood, it's made with hardwood plywood. And the outer face is the only thing that's got the real valuable hardwood on it. The rest of that's going to be either pine or some other inferior hardwood. But since that's the only piece you're going to see on the outside, that it may only be a tenth of an inch thick.
That hardwood.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I'd like to tell you a little bit more about cypress.
You can tell you about
back in years, I reckon in the late 30s, people used to have to go out in the swamp to cut these cypress. They had to get up on horses, have a horse on this side, one on this side, and had usually the same kind of saw, though you cross-cut saw. We call them gator tails then. And, you know, cypress got a big butt on it, down the butt. So that's the reason they had to be up on them horses. They get up there and saw them down. So I think where the deadheads come from, where lots of trees were left, south was left. Don't you all think so? Where they left in the swamp, people didn't get out on the high water comes over and stayed there. Because I know where I live on the Apalachicola River, the National Forest, right close to the National Forest. Here's some cypress in there now. People let them go in there and get sometimes. You have to see the forest people are getting, but they let them go in there and get them, and it takes them a week to get them, dig them out. They can't get the machine, so battery, they can't get the machine. They take weeks to get down there. They dig them out. And
about 4 foot
of course,
tall.
It pays off, they say. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Years ago, we had some large cypress companies in the state of Florida. They went into the swamps, or primarily in the rivers mostly, up and down the rivers, yeah. And they girdled, what we call girdled those trees, simply cutting around them at the bottom to kill them. Mm-hmm. And they stood there for a period of time till they died and dried out and became light enough to float down the river to the mill or to a loading area. A lot of that went to the bottom, and a lot of our deadhead cypress comes from that source also.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Here's some nice ones in this Appalachian forest. There's some nice ones. Stand 4 foot high.
Yeah.
I met a fellow that goes and gets some of that stuff out of the Apalachicola River, and he was telling me about it one time. He said that what he has to do, he goes out and does it by himself, and he takes two large John boats, and he's got them rigged so that they're spaced out somehow apart from each other, and he has to dive down in the water, which if you've ever looked at the Apalachicola River, it's not clear. He dives down underneath the water and finds the deadhead cypress, and this is under maybe 8 or 10 feet of water. He gets a cable underneath it at one end and a cable underneath it somewhere up the log. And these are logs that, like he had talked about, were already cut. They had been sawed off years ago, and they're laying down there. Some of them are cut to length, and they're underwater. And he just takes come-alongs, and they're stuck in the mud. So he'll get a cable, and I don't know how he gets the cable underneath it, but he gets the cable underneath it, and he has come-alongs on his two boats. And he'll come along on it for a little while, and it'll pull the boat down into the water to where there's no freeboard left, and then he'll just wait, and eventually the pressure will push the log up a little bit, and he'll do it some more. And like he's saying, that's how it takes them maybe a week to get a couple of them out, because that's the way they have to do it.
Sure will. Yep.
But what they're talking about, the deadhead cypress, it's just the pure heart of the cypress, because all the sapwood is rotted away over the years.
It's very expensive.
They sure is.
You're very scarce.
How much does one of them weigh?
That's calling what size and how many feet is in it.
Yeah.
That's calling how many feet
it is. Depends on the end. There's not that much of it, and it depends on how bad a man wants it. It's real scarce, and it goes
so expensive.
Whatever the top the market value is can be any figure.
That's right.
Yes.
Sure
yes.
Is.
If you went to a cypress mill now and bought a 12-inch board with any length to it, you're going to pay $1 a foot for it.
Oh, yes.
And that's the kind of cypress we have today, which is second-growth cypress.
Yeah. So to put it in perspective, one of these logs may have 200 or 300 feet in it, if it's a good-sized log.
But you know, not very long.
That can be the whole log. It can be the whole log. Yes.
Oh, yeah, certain length.
So if you had one that was had 200 feet in it and it was worth $1,000, $1,000 a thousand, or $2,000 a thousand, then you're looking at maybe $400 or $500 for that one log.
It sure is.
That's why you can take a week to get out there with right. Come along and get it. And besides, you know, there's nobody else that's willing to go out there and do that.
I mean, it sure will show.
Okay, I hate to cut off this great discussion, but we have another topic to go on to. We'll take a couple minutes break and then come back and talk with women who are working in a variety of forest industries. And thank you to all of our participants.
Okay.
Some of this audience has been here before. I see some familiar faces. But the next topic that we're going to talk about for the next half hour or so is the role of women in Florida forestry. When you think about going out and tramping around in the woods and cutting down trees and working in sawmills and all the rest of it, the image, I suppose, that comes to people's mind is that this is a men's job. But more and more, that's not the case at all. And in fact, we have three women here who are involved in quite a variety of different jobs involving forestry in this part of the state. Who are here to tell you about what they do and about some of the experiences that they've had working in a trade that's somewhat untraditional for women. You've already been introduced, those of you who've been with us, to the first person on my left here, Barbara Dye, who is the plant manager for Corbett Cypress. She is the person who runs that operation and makes that mill go. Next person down is Lugene Baxley. She owns and runs a logging operation. It's a family operation, and we'll talk more about that aspect of it a little bit later on. But she's the boss lady with her two sons, and her daughter works for her as well. And then last down on my left is Nancy Pywell, who's a professor of forestry in the Department of Forestry at the University of Florida. So they'll be talking about what they do. Let's see, I always pick on Barbara, so this time I won't. Nancy, why don't you start and talk about how you got involved in this and some of what it's meant to you as a woman being in this field.
I got involved in forestry kind of through the back door. After graduating from college and with a degree in education, I taught school for 3 years, this elementary school, and decided that wasn't what I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing. So I went back to graduate school in a program dealing with natural resources and natural resource planning. Was offered an assistantship in graduate school interpreting aerial photographs for one of the professors in the forestry department, and through that got interested in taking some of the other forestry courses, and I enjoyed them a lot. I felt confident in working in the outdoors, in dealing with the resource, and had a commitment to try to conserve our natural resources, and so forestry seemed an appropriate place to go. So I sort of almost fell into it accidentally. Although, one of the things I hadn't mentioned before, when I was in high school, I took one of those ridiculous preference tests they used to give us, the Cooter preference test, and one of the things that it said on that, with all the answers I gave, was that I should either be a beekeeper or a forester. Somehow or another, my guidance counselor in high school never ever thought about pointing me in the direction of forestry. And if she had, it would have been so nice, because it would have shortcutted the whole system, and I could have found out about this like 8 years sooner and gotten ahead of the game. But back in those days, guidance counselors never suggested that women become foresters. Things have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, I'll pick on you now. You have a good story about how you got into this whole routine and how you got into your job.
Yeah, I got into my job by damn. You know, some guy dared me to do something, and I did it. And I kind of liked it, and I've been there ever since. So mine was just like a dare. Before then, I was an aircraft mechanic, so I still was doing something that, you know, they say a woman shouldn't do, but I was working on aircraft planes.
Lugene, I'll go on to you for a little while. We'll come back. Barbara's got more stories to tell, I know. But tell them about, well, both how you got involved in being in charge of the family operation, but also all the stuff that you did up to that point. You've worked real hard for a long time.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of all of it. The way it all started, I was just the housewife, and then my husband got sick, and then I had to go to the woods with him every day, do all the parts running, picking up tires, loading tires. Anything that come to hand, I had to do, driving a dump truck, hauling chips to the woods, to put in sand beds. And then after my husband passed away, then I told the boys, I said, well, we'll just sell the business. No, Mama, we've been in it too long. And one of the boys had 8 years, and one had 6 years with us. So I knew they had to have something to do, and I still had to have a paycheck coming in. I said, okay, if you think we can do it, we'll go for it. So I stuck with it, and now I'm more or less just kind of semi-retired, and the boys does. One, I have two chipping operation and a logging operation. One boy runs one runs the other. They couldn't get along with just one operation, so I started up another one. Because both of them wanted to be boss in the woods, and it don't work. So every night I heard an argument, and I said, okay, we'll put a stop to this. So then I started up a logging operation, and Dan runs it, and then Tony runs the chipping operation. And I have 25 employees. And I have to take care of all the taxes and all the bills, see that all the bills is paid, all the fuel bills and everything, all the parts is doing. And my new husband does my parts running for me now, and I just sit back and kind of relax a little bit.
Barbara, do you ever have problems with men on the job, with you being in charge of telling them what to do?
Well, not anymore. I used to, you know. Well, I do have a little problem with one guy, but I can work around him. But now that everybody knows that where I stand at and how I do my job, and I work a little harder than them, work a lot of them, you know, the labor. I work just about that much harder than them for one reason. If the boss work hard, you know they're going to work hard. So this one guy, he ain't going to do too much of nothing. All he like to do is argue with me, so I kind of like work around him. He's the one that you can't really, well, maybe another man probably can tell him something, but I can't tell him nothing and it'd be right. So I had to prove it to him that it's going to work out if he just do it my way, and it does every time.
What jobs do you do around that mill?
Mainly I do all of it, but my main job is to walk from one section to another section to make sure they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. We run a bagging crew, we run a stacking, shaking, we load trucks, and I do all of that too, but I just go from one section to another just to make sure everybody putting what they're supposed to put in the bag, on the trucks, and doing their job.
Nancy, tell us about your experiences. Do you have problems, you know, sort of making your mark as a woman and dealing with the other men in your end of the profession?
There have been times when it's been tough sledding working with guys, but I have been very fortunate that in all three of the universities that I've worked with, the fellows have been, for the most part, very receptive. And so long as I've maintained my sense of humor and have worked hard to do my job and do it well, eventually even the toughest of them have come around. When I started working at one of the universities up north, the first couple months I was there, I perceived I was not really a welcome addition to the faculty. I was the first woman that had been on the faculty in that school, and it wasn't the way it was supposed to be, obviously. And it was probably about 2 or 3 months before one of the fellows came up to me and says, you know, we all go out Friday afternoon down to the railroad station for a beer. Why don't you come on down? And up until that point, nobody had ever told me about it, let alone invited me. But I was very gratified that when I left there after a year and a half, they gave me a party, and I could tell that they were really going to miss me. And it made me feel really good that I was able to turn them around. And it was strictly through doing my job and doing it the best I could and maintaining a sense of humor when somebody gave me a tough time.
I know you've had to keep your sense of humor a few times, Barbara.
Yeah, I had to keep my sense of humor just about every day with this guy, you know, the one I was telling y'all about. But actually, if he don't come to work that day, he kind of like make me feel bad because he really my energy. He the one getting me to going because I know he going to have something to say that ain't gonna be, oh, woman can't do this right here. Woman ain't got no business doing that. Then I just have to just get out there and show them that I can do it. And matter of fact, any woman can do it if you know they put the mind to it. So then when you do it, he just kind of like sits back a little. he's a trip.
Have the guys there ever played practical jokes on you? I remember one story you might tell these folks.
They only did one. Well, I take that back. They did a couple of them, but only one that really was got to me. When I first started working at them, the guys, you know, I was stacking lumber just like they was. I was doing everything they was doing, you know. So they want to teach me a lesson that a woman couldn't do it, really. So at lunchtime, we go down and we lay down real low, lays around, you know, take off his shoes and just chill out for 30 minutes. And guy put glue in my shoes. But after that, I ain't have no more practice jokes. No, I just put my shoes back on and just pretend that didn't even happen. But believe me, I had a time getting them shoes off. But no, it just was pace. That's all it was. But one time, my co-worker right there with that blue pants on, him and another buddy, they turned me upside down and just jilled me in the sawdust and buried me in the sawdust, you know. It's just a thing that they just feel like they just had to do. So besides, I'm the smallest and the shortest out on my job. The rest of them is huge.
Lujean, have you ever had problems with the contractors that you work for giving you trouble?
No, ma'am. I have had very nice men to work with me, and they had always known that I didn't take any bull off of anybody anyway. So they've been very nice.
Good. I know that, Nancy, tell them about your chainsaw experience. I thought this was very illustrative of a woman's life in this industry.
When I started out in graduate school and after I finished up graduate school, I had never had a whole lot of experience cutting down trees. And in fact, when I was married, my husband would not let me use the chainsaw to cut the firewood. You know, I could stack it and I could stoke the fire, but he wouldn't let me use the chainsaw. And I came to understand that he had a valid reason for that. He wanted to make sure that I didn't get hurt because I had to be there to take care of our child. And I understand he was looking at it from that point of view. But very shortly after he split, I talked to the forester at the university where I was working at the time. I said to him, I do a lot of workshops with foresters and landowners and work with these people, and I don't really feel confident when I'm talking about chainsaw safety and cutting down trees because I haven't really done it. So would you take me out in the forest and point me to a tree and tell me what I need to do? So he took me up when somebody had ordered some wood and set me out there and instructed me how to start the chainsaw on the safety, the whole routine, and put me to work cutting down a hemlock tree that was probably about this big around. And he stood there and talked me through it, and I got that, you know, first we had to go through and fell some of the other trees so there'd be a clear path for it, and then make all the cuts the right way, the right direction, use the wedges and so forth. Got that tree, felled it, and then limbed it and bucked the limbs up for firewood and cut the rest of it so it'd be ready for the skidder to come and take it out. And that was a situation where I don't think I was proving anything to anybody else. I was proving to myself that I could do it. And I think the experience really helped me because now when I talk to people about cutting down trees or chainsaw safety or whatever, I know what I'm talking about. And it's not just something that I learned from a book. I've had a chance to prove to myself that I can do it. So now I feel confident in giving advice to other folks. But it was awful fun.
But you found out it wasn't easy work, didn't it?
Oh, it was hard work. And in fact, when I mentioned something about doing that later to my ex, he says, he lets you cut down a hemlock. Those are the unsafest tree to cut because I don't know if any of y'all are from up north, but hemlocks have a tendency towards heart rot. So they can be really tough, tricky trees to cut down and not particularly safe. So it probably wasn't the best thing to start on, but it was a good, solid tree, and we had fun with it and got hot and sweaty and had a great time.
Yeah.
How many women do you have in your classes now? Can you talk about a percentage or?
Bill, what kind of percentage do we have on women in our classes right now? One of my colleagues is here. Okay, about one out of ten in forestry, and about 40%. I know at a lot of schools it's more than 50% women in some of the natural resource fields. And at University of Florida, I think we lead the nation in women on the faculty in forestry. We have three professional foresters with their PhDs working on the faculty at the University of Florida, and that's more than in any other forestry school in the country. So we're real proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice because it meant when I came here, I wasn't the first woman on the faculty, and I didn't have to prove to the guys that you could be there and do what needed to be done. I had a wonderful role model in Dr. Kathy Ewell to smooth out the road for me at University of Florida.
Does anybody in the audience have questions that they'd like to ask any of our experts here?
The lady in the orange shirt. How many years have you been on the Army Bureau?
Since 1983.
So you're kind of new in a way you're not.
Well, we've been in the business since 1954, and I had made every step he made.
Did you grow up in a family that was...
No, I grew up in a farming family. But my husband was from a forestry all the way through, even his granddad and the granddad before then. His father had a sawmill. Four or five of his brothers is in the timber business.
So you've kind of learned
from...
Uh-huh,
yeah.
And it lets him help you slip into it.
Right, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because, see, he was sick for a while, and I went every day that he went. We left at 5:30 in the morning and got in around dark or after.
So have you done any of the real hard work?
I haven't run a chainsaw much. I have run some of the skidders and, like I said, the dump truck, and I can back the log trucks and trailers. I never have pulled a load. I've rode a lot of loads when I thought a man was fooling around on me and messing around and stopping at the Jiffy stores and what have you. But once I thought I was going to have to drive a log truck, and my son that's sitting in the back, I think he was in the ninth grade, and the man that was supposed to drive the truck that day was sick. And my husband called, and he said, I've got to have that truck down here. He says, there's not but one thing for you to do, and that's drive it. Well, we had to go through the main part of town, and it was a good 60 miles from home. So I called the school, and I said, Danny, can you drive the log truck? Sure, Mama, I can, because he's always, ever since he was little, would sit in the men's lap when he wasn't but 6 or 8 years old to run the first piece of equipment. Because he wanted to be the first one to run it. And so I went to school and got him, and we took that log truck to my husband and loaded that load that day. Scared to death, no driver's license, no insurance to cover, no nothing. I wouldn't even think about it today, we would just lose that load.
How many acres do you take care of?
Well, we contract for Georgia Pacific, see, so they buy the timber, and then I own all the equipment, and we just contract cut and haul it for them. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people that aren't familiar with the whole forest industry and forest products industry don't understand that there is a wide variety and a wide diversity of professions that deal with the forest industry, because you have the foresters who help to manage it and provide information and advice on what to plant and where to plant and how to plant it. And then you have rangers who might be involved in fire suppression. Some of the foresters are involved in fire suppression, but that isn't usually a job of a professional forester. Then you get into the research, developing new kinds of trees and learning what should be planted where. You have the technician positions with people who are cruising timber and measuring it and determining how much wood is out there, so that when her company comes in, they know what they're supposed to cut and how many trees and which trees, so it can be brought in and taken to the mills, where it's a really diverse industry. And I think very few people in the general public understand that there are dozens of careers dealing with forestry that aren't necessarily being a forester. I probably left out a lot. Which one are you thinking of? Well, there are a bunch of people that are involved in fire right. protection and fire suppression, and if they weren't out there, most of us wouldn't have a job to do.
Another thing that a lot of people don't look at or don't think about, they look down and kind of put us down in a low class. They say a logger is a low class, because I've been called a low class pulpwooder, which, I mean, it didn't bother me, but they don't stop to think, what would they do if they didn't have trees?
Well, when you get to talking about fire and forestry, though, especially in Florida, you need to realize that fire is an important part of the ecosystem here, and if we didn't have fires, we wouldn't have the pine stands we have.
Right.
And we need, you all need to help other people to understand that Smokey Bear, if he did his job 100% in Florida, we probably wouldn't have the $7 billion industry in this state supporting the economy here. Because if you don't have fire in Florida forests, you end up with stands of trees that are so thick you can't get people in there, let alone animals. And it isn't good habitat, and it isn't productive for the thousands of forest products we all want to use. And it's something a lot of people don't understand. Fire can be good in a forest, but fire can also be bad in a forest. And it's up to the foresters and folk who work in the profession to see that it's used as a tool instead of as a weapon.
Yeah, because if you stop and think about how many paper products that everybody uses. I mean, just start in the household. And how you could even write a phone number down, nothing. And all of it comes from the logger.